At long last, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is indeed upon us. A convivial conversation fest between myself, Gregory S. Cawk, Esquire, and a variety of musical potentates from hither and yon. Brought to you by our friends at Wildwood Guitars and our friends at Fishman Transducers, of course, both of which I've had long-standing and continuing relationships with, and I'm very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor to bring you Chewing the Doggone Gristle. We've got a bunch of fun guests, some you have heard of, some maybe not so much. It'll be a little bit of discovery and a little bit of chaos all rolled into one. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Now, without any further ado, let's chew some gristle. Folks, we got an old buddy of mine, Chicago blues potentate, purveyor of contemporary blues. People who have been following blues music for the last couple of decades will have undoubtedly heard and seen and felt the power of Nick Moss and his many great bands. Let us converse now with this mighty potentate as he dwells down in Chicago, Illinois, this week on Chewing the Gristle. It's Nick Moss. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the time has come again for another convivial conversation here on Chewing the Gristle with yours truly, Greg Cawk, and I have the mighty Nick Moss, Chicago blues purveyor of the highest quality, and cool cat. Can you believe those words that are flowing like caffeine-fueled morsels of the night, Nick? How are you?
I'm great. That's a great introduction. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Oh, my pleasure. I see you are also in an orange room. Now, people won't be able to hear this.
No.
No, they'll be able to hear this, but they won't be able to see it.
It's like a burnt red.
Oh, it is.
It's a reddish, brownish, orangish. I don't know.
I like it. But as you can see, I am in a similar environment.
Very orange. But I also have this that's orange.
Oh, look at that dog. Hey there, puppers.
That's Daisy May.
Daisy May, the powerful hound.
Yeah.
Now, how you doing? What's been happening?
Just been working, doing good, man. I see you've been working. You just got off the road, and I just got off the road. And I think we were both on the East Coast around the same time.
We were. I saw many of the same places we were playing, you were going to be playing, and all that kind of stuff. That's a good thing. It's good to be out and about doing the do.
Yeah, man. It was the last couple of months we've been working pretty hard, and it's been great. Great crowds, and just been having fun playing. You know, I missed it after COVID all those years. We didn't do a whole lot until this year kicked in, and this year we kind of eased into it slowly at the beginning of the year, and then like just kept picking up and like rolling hard, and then finally now I get to take a break.
Yes. So how long are you home for that you don't have to go back out again for?
I got home this past Friday, and that was, or just the day before, I'm sorry. And that was my last gig for the year. I don't have another gig until I see you next month.
Yes, indeed. I'm not quite sure if this is going to be out by then, but if it is, folks, January 10th, we'll be at Fitzgerald's engaging in more convivial conversation with some musical accentuation.
Yes, sir.
And I'm looking forward to that. We had a good time at when we did that little co-bill thing at the Martyrs. That was good times. I loved your band, man. It's smoking.
Thank you, man. That was your doing. You invited me, and I think that's the second time you've invited me. So I really appreciate that. I always have fun. I think it's cool for the crowd because our styles are vastly different, but they're different. And I think it's cool because people get to see two different.
Exactly. You know, it's complimentary.
Yeah.
Which is the way it should be.
Yeah. I like that, man. You know, I feel like I've always wondered why in recent times, like the festivals, like me being on the more blues based.
Sure.
Part of this business, our festivals are blues. And, you know, the blues varies between rock blues, funk blues, and traditional blues. I'm more traditional blues. But I still like it when I see some of these festivals, man. I'm like, you know, back in the 60s when I watch all these old videos and stuff, and they had like everybody at a festival.
Right.
Rock, folk, soul, blues.
Jazz, the whole nine. Yeah.
And I think that like expanded more people's tastes towards all kinds of music. And I'm just wondering why we don't have more of that kind of thing.
That would be nice. It would be nice, because I agree with you. Well, that's one of the things I always liked about how Summerfest operated up here for so long in Milwaukee. It's Shane. I'm not gonna diss it as it exists now. It's just that obviously, financial interests take over certain things, and they have a tendency to go for the lowest common denominator. And for the longest time, Summerfest had a thing where, they had a jazz stage, they had a blues stage, they had country stage, and they were loose affiliations with those genres, but whoever would be touring that summer in all those genres, they would be there. So one particular day you could, Albert King would be playing in one place. You can go next door to the Cajun tent and, Buttwig Zydeco is playing, you go over to the jazz stage or Michael Brecker, It used to be such an all in, inclusive thing. Yeah, it's frustrating. But, if we want to get into all the frustrating aspects of contemporary life, I think we'd be here for a while.
I hear you.
That being said, I always say I function from an attitude of extreme gratitude, because knowing what I know, I'm so lucky even to have the foothold I have.
I don't know how old you are, Greg, but I just turned 54, and I feel like, especially in the last 5, 6, 7 years, man, I'm a slow learner, but within the last 5 to 7 years, I'm really starting to feel like how you feel. Like at this age, I can't believe that I'm actually where I am right now. Like,
right.
I used to, like, when I was 20, I was like, well, you're at the top.
Right. Exactly.
I'm comfortably in the middle.
Exactly. I've got 3 years on you. I was born in 66. I think you were born in 69, right?
Okay, yeah. You're my brother's age, yeah.
Yes, indeed. So speaking of that, how did you guys get into blues at such a young age? Was it just something that, what was the entree into that music?
So really, my mom's record collection and my dad's record collection, we grew up, both of them, like blue collar workers. My mom's a beautician and my dad's a pipe fitter, worked heating and air conditioning commercial all our lives, but they just loved music. So music was always around the house. My brother and I were left to our own devices, but at a fairly young age, when my mom decided, she could trust us. Big mistake. Anyways. So like at the end of the week, two young boys at home have destroyed the house. So we didn't watch a lot of Saturday morning cartoons. We got our chores done on Saturday morning. And the only rule was, if for entertainment was we could turn on the radio or play records while we were cleaning and doing our chores. So we kind of like played DJ every week, kind of traded off playing DJ. And that was, I just remember that being like kind of a cool thing, getting to pick the music and to pick the records. And my mom in particular was really her eclectic taste. I mean, she went all across the board, but she was really heavily soul influenced and blues influenced, folk influenced. My dad was big band,
right,
and early doo-wop and rock and roll. My mom liked everything. And, but as far as the blues thing goes, I don't know. I felt like for whatever reason, blues and soul music just spoke to me at an early age. I was probably too young to understand even the term organic, but
right,
I could feel it. Like I clearly recall my mom had the record, Indianola Mississippi Seeds, B.B. Yep. King. And at first, I just loved the cover because it was a cover of a watermelon sliced in half with a guitar neck in it and a super reverb. Well, I know now, but then I didn't know. It was just an amplifier, and this watermelon guitar is plugged into the amplifier. And then my mom would play this. Like, she'd wear it out. She played the record all the time when she was cooking. And I just remembered, I don't know, I'd hear BB sing in a falsetto, and I'd hear that note just stinging.
Yeah.
And it would stop me dead in my tracks, like this electric bolt running through my body. And I just, I couldn't get enough of it. And I just, you know, and from then on, like any kind of music that was remotely similar to it, like I just wanted to know who that was, where can I hear more of it? And my brother was really, he's your age, so about 3.5 years older than me at the time. And my parents bought us guitars for Christmas one year. But I was probably not ready for it because I might have been 5 or 6. And Joe was ready, and he was like instantly could play. Like he could pick up the guitar, hear something, and just play it back. Like he figured it out.
Wow.
He was like one of those kind of prodigy kind of guys. And so when I got about a year or two older, I would just like go try and sneak his guitar from him, because after 2 years, he had graduated to an electric guitar. And then I'd watch him play in the basement with his friends that he made that were musicians. And they were all playing blues-based rock records, Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Early Rolling Stones stuff. And then they started reading Cream magazine. And, you know, before all the big guitar magazines came out. And all those guys were talking about Chicago blues legends. And then my brother figured, wait a second, my mom's got some of these records in her collection that Jimmy Page and Robert Plant are talking about. So he started digging them out. And then I used to just go sit in my brother's room when he was playing records. We've always gotten along that way. You know, it was never kind of like, get out of here, you're bothering me thing. It was, I mostly he just tolerated me and, you know, just like, go ahead, sit down. So when he was playing records, I just sit and listen, and like he was the one doing all the discovering, but it was all the music I already liked because my mom played it and I knew I liked it.
Ah, awesome.
So pretty much that was it. And when we just, as I got older and started getting more interested in music and playing, and my brother caught me one day playing his guitar and finally had enough of that and went out and bought me a bass and an amp at a garage sale. And I still have a bass, old Silvertone bass, and literally threw it in my lap on the couch one day and said, here, if you want to play, play this, because we need a bass player. Because I'm sure you went through the same thing. Like in every neighborhood, there's 50 guitar players.
Right.
Drummers,
no bass players.
No bass players.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's how that happened. And then I was like, oh, I get to hang out with you guys and play music? Okay, then I'll do that until, you know, he went off to college one day and ended up going to Berkeley for a couple of years. And I was supposed to be a, you know, a big sports guy and was being recruited by schools for football and wrestling. And then I had a like genetic problem with my kidney that didn't surface till I was 18 and kind of blew any chances or any kind of collegiate sports.
Ah, man.
And my brother, again, took me to Wise Fools Pub. I was literally at Children's Memorial Hospital across the street because my problem, without going into too much detail, was they should have found out when I was a kid. And the only specialist was at Children's Memorial. He was a kidney specialist. And he basically lobbied for me to be there at 18 because no one else could fix the problem.
Man.
And one day my brother, during my recovery, he had heard on WXRT, this band, and he's like, dude, I heard this band. I'm going to sneak you out tonight. We're going to go across the street. They're playing at Wise Fools Pub right across the street. And it turned out it was Little Charlie and the Night Cat's very first Alligator record.
Ah, cool.
And they didn't have a big following in Chicago then, so there was only like 5-10 people in there. My brother put on my dad had this full-length camel's hair coat that he got in the military and put it on me to cover, because I not to get too gross, but I had tubes coming out of me until I was completely healed,
right?
You know, because my kidneys were shut down. And he put those in a shopping bag and shoved them under my arm, closed the coat, walked and had me put my head down, walked me into the bar. I don't know, he told the bouncer some kind of BS story to get me in. And I watched these guys play, and I remember Rick Estrin walking by, and he's like a big, for those of you guys listening, if you don't know, Rick's like a big clothes hound. He's immaculate. And he saw this camel hair coat on this kid, and he's like, where the hell did you get that camel's hair? And he like grabbed me by the lapels and stood me up to look at the jacket. when he opened it up, these tubes in the bag fell out. And he just, what the hell happened to you? Did you get shot? And I was like, no, man, nothing that, you know, dramatic, but just had, you know. And then he called Charlie over. He goes, Chuck, come here. You got to see this. And Chuck walks over and he goes, look at this kid, man. He's at death's door and he's coming to see us. And Charlie just looks at me and just goes, huh, and shrugs and turns around and walks away. And Rick, but Rick was very enthralled with the story. And then that was it for me that night. I just watched these guys play and I'm like, man, I don't know. The musicianship was there. The showmanship was there. And one thing, for me, like, I know there was bands playing blues-based stuff that were white bands. But when I started really getting into blues and listening to, like, really old traditional blues and listening to, like, early Chicago blues, like, you know, Muddy Waters, Little Walter, Howlin' Wolf, all that stuff.
Right.
I hadn't heard a white band play that. So I didn't even know that was a thing that you could be white and play blues like that.
Uh-huh.
Like I just didn't, you know, it didn't occur to me that like white guys played old traditional blues, you know? And so that blew my mind. I'm like, wait, I can do that. I can't go to college. And I don't know, something clicked in my brain that night. And, you know, maybe some say maybe it could have been for the worst, but I'm cool with it. And I just made up my mind that night. I go, this is what I want to do in my life.
And the rest is history. So what happened from then? You recovered, obviously, from your malady. And did you go to college or did you just go right out to it?
Hell no. I was stupid, man. I probably could have went to college. But in my mind, I was like, the hell do I want to go to college for now? I can't play football. I can't wrestle. And I've been introduced to all this cool music. And it just started, you know, I was like 18 years old and we just started going into the city and hanging out more. And my brother was already playing in a band. And then he got a gig with Buddy Scott and the Rib Tips. And I occasionally would fill in for their bass player when their bass player was, he couldn't make the gig for whatever reason. I'll just leave it at that. And when he wouldn't show up and I was hanging with my brother, Buddy would go, well, here, Nick, you play bass tonight. Cause Buddy owned all the gear.
Ah.
So the bass and the amp were already there and he just threw me on bass. And I learned on stage. My brother did too. And it wasn't all the time, but occasionally that would happen. And then one day, you know, Melvin Smith, who plays bass with Larry Bell, and he was Coco Taylor's bass player for a long time. He had kind of, we became friends at some of these blues jams, and he called me on the blue one day and he said, hey man, I got asked to go on tour with the legendary blues man because Calvin Jones is retiring and they need a bass player, but I'm on the road with Coco and I gave Willie your phone number. So he might call you. And I was like, not even 19.
Crazy.
And so I got that gig. But if I back up, I will say this, that I had a short stint. Again, just hanging out at blues jams, I got a short stint being hired by Jimmy Dawkins. But that was, I was so green and not ready for that. And Jimmy just didn't have I'm not going to say the patience, but I don't think he knew how to explain to me how to play with him because I don't know, listening to someone like Jimmy Dawkins, who wasn't really much about staying in time and playing the changes. It was very loose.
Right.
And so I just wasn't ready. And when he let me go, I remember being told, you know, that I didn't have what it took, basically. Anyway, I mean, he was cool about it, but just knowing in my mind, I didn't have what it took to keep that job. It really upset me. And I remember going into the woodshed pretty hard and going downtown and seeing every bass player I could see. Like Calvin Jones was still in town playing bass. Bob Scorger, Willie Black, Willie Kent, all these great bass players. And then I got this call, like I said, from from Willie Smith because Melvin couldn't do the gig. And I ended up keeping that gig for like 3.5 years. And that's when I moved to guitar, because a year into that stint, the guitar player had a domestic issue and had to leave. And Willie said, well, you want to play guitar and you already know the bass lines. Why don't you switch to guitar and you can teach the bass player? that's how I ended up switching to guitar.
So talk a little bit about going on the road with those guys at age 19.
Oh man, it seems like yesterday. Every time I stop to think about it, like when someone asks me a question like this and I realize how long ago it was, it still just seems like yesterday. And it was, you asked about, well, did I go to college? I didn't go to college, but in this profession, I went to the best university ever.
Right.
And I had most of the best private tutors, because I literally had like Muddy Waters timekeeper as the guy to teach me how to play in time and play with feel with Willie Smith.
Right.
I mean, that, and as a bass player, you can't ask for anything more than that.
Right.
And then when you switch to guitar, it helps you understand what's going on behind you. And eventually I ended up getting the job with Jimmy Rogers as his second guitar player. And that guy, it was a bigger band, two guitars, harmonica, piano, drums, and learning how to play in an ensemble style. It's, I don't know how to explain it other than, I feel like there's a lot of types of music where everything is part based.
Right.
And even in some of the modern blues acts that I hear now, I feel like I only hear the guitar player playing his part, the bass player playing his part, the drummer playing his part, the keyboard, like everyone's playing their parts, but nobody's playing together.
Right. I hear you. Yep.
And it's like, I realized playing with Jimmy, and he explained it to me too about like it's a dance, it's a conversation, it's using your ears, stepping in and stepping out, and sliding in and sliding out. And when you listen to those old records and you listen to the way those guys play, it's a moving parts.
Right.
So it seems very haphazard to an untrained ear, but when you know what's going on, and it's still one of the most beautiful things when I listen to like an old Muddy Waters record.
Oh, absolutely.
Hear these guys playing Muddy's voice, and it's Jimmy Rogers' guitar in the back, or Luther Tucker's guitar in the back, and Walter or Mojo Buford or Junior Wells, that at the time, all them playing their different thing on harmonica, and Otis Spann playing piano underneath. And I don't know, man, it's just one of those things. So I got to learn that firsthand from basically the architects of the Chicago sound. So I am beyond grateful. Like what you said earlier in this thing, like when I look back at that and I'm like, you know, I feel bad for some of the guys coming up now, because those guys aren't around.
Sure. Yeah.
And I feel like there's a few guys around that are still doing it right. And I've been very fortunate to have some good musicians, some really good young guys come in and out of my band. It's only been made recently aware to me that, like, I guess I'm the conduit, because I'm the next guy to pass it with my knowledge.
Exactly. Pass it on to the youngsters. Yep.
Yeah. And I feel like, I still feel like I'm 12 years old in my
right.
head.
Like,
I'm 54 now, man.
But, I get it.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a lot of times too where I think, you know, as much as like time, it does seem like some things were yesterday, but at the same time, it's like, I think I've got my money's worth. I mean, in terms of,
yeah,
you know, it's like, yeah, all that stuff happened, and I'm glad I'm where I'm at now, because I wouldn't want to have to do a lot of those things over again. But tell me a little bit about how Chicago, or just, you know, making a living as a musician now. I mean, obviously you travel on the road. I know I'm on the road all the time, because I always say, you know, I'm from Milwaukee here. And I always say, if I had to make a living just playing in Milwaukee as a musician, I wouldn't, because right. There's just no way to do it unless
I would have to do things I just don't want to do. I mean, if you want to do original music and you know, more things that aren't cover material of the, you know, the basic tracks that are the most popular with the everyman, you know, you got to travel. Right. And I'm wondering, how has Chicago changed as a place where you can do some regional work for a period of time and then have to go out on the road versus how it was back in the day?
I think there were more places back in the day to play around town, and especially for blues, because it's, you know, known as one of the big cities for blues. So there, right. I believe there was more places to play. And I play a very niche style of blues. I mean, my stuff's very traditional, and there's not a lot of that here in Chicago. Most of these guys are pretty modern, and they're really good at what they do, but there's just not a lot of traditional based blues. So I probably have a little bit less to choose from to play.
Gotcha.
So I don't know. I mean, I feel like I remember Jimmy Rogers telling me, I used to ask him all the time, and this is when there was a lot of gigs to play. Like, Jimmy, why don't we ever play more at home when we're home? How come we don't need to do any more gigs at home? And Jimmy just looked at me one day. He goes, man, because when I'm at home, I'm just a nut. Can I swear here?
Yeah, go right ahead.
He said, because when I'm at home, I'm just another motherfucker from here.
Yeah, well, that's a fact. Yeah.
He said, but when I go on the road, I'm somebody special.
Yeah.
And they pay me like I was somebody special.
Exactly. That's it in a nutshell. Yep.
And so, like, he intentionally didn't play in Chicago very often. And if he did, he asked for the money that he wanted. And, you know, for the most part, he got it. But that's why he didn't play in Chicago very often. Now, I'm not saying I'm at that point where I can just tell these guys I'm not playing unless. I mean, I get what I get. I get paid. You know, I'm happy with what I get paid. And I've built up, you know, my career where I can be okay getting the money I get here in Chicago. But yeah, I make more money on the road. I do.
Right. Yep.
And I have to stay busy. And it's one of the things, like, I try to tell some of the young guys and young musicians out there, is like, you have to be, we got another one. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
That's pork chop. You didn't eat that. I got Daisy a pork chop, but I tell these guys, I say, you have to be prepared if you're going to go into the business. You have to be prepared to do everything it takes to be successful. And by everything it takes, it means, like, you can't sit and wait for it to fall in your lap.
Oh, absolutely.
You
can't sit
and wait for it to come to you. Being proactive in this particular business is like the best attribute you could have.
Yep.
I know guys that are, I'm not going to try to be a jerk, but I know guys that really talent-wise are far below some other guys with a lot of talent, but they're so good at getting work and putting this stuff out there.
Of course.
Stay busy.
Yep.
So, like, you have to be proactive. You have to be always putting one foot in front of the other. Even if you get pushed back a couple steps, you got to, well, okay, and then put another foot back in front of the other and get back and do it.
That's absolutely
just how it is in this business. And I learned that a long time ago. And a lot of it was from those guys that I spoke of, especially Willie Smith. That guy, you know, was one of the hardest working dudes I've ever met in my life. He never let anybody drive the van. That dude would put 30 plus hours behind a vehicle nonstop. I mean, we drove straight back and forth from Chicago to Edmonton many times because we used to do these week-long residencies up in Edmonton. He'd get behind the wheel, straight through, and on the way back, so never let anyone drive.
Wild.
Stop. I remember stopping on a mountain in a snowstorm because one of the fan belts blew on the van, and he gets out in a full-on snowstorm, and it's like probably 20 below zero, climbing under the van. He's got a toolbox with him, and he's got plenty of fan belts because he's been through the routine before and he knows that he got to have them. So he tells me, reach under the bench seat. I got fan belts. Reach under the other seat. Give me my toolbox. Climbs under the van, and I'm standing out there freezing, and he slides back out from underneath the van and goes, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm here to help you. He goes, man, get back in the van. Ain't no sense in both of us being cool. And I was like, you know, like that kind of stuff. I mean, that guy worked his ass off and didn't, and finally got a Grammy 2 years before he passed away in his 80s.
Wild.
You know? And he's also the one that told me, when I asked him, I said, man, will you ever get just tired of like doing this stuff? And like, you ever wonder like, where's the finish line? Right. You know, in so many words. And he said to me one time, he said, man, you, let me tell you something. He goes, man, you got to carry yourself a big machete because the vines are thick. He goes, but if you squint, you can see the light through them vines. And, and he goes, and I'm hacking away. And one of these days I'll come out into the sunshine. He said that, man. And I swear to God, I've always followed that since then. I'm like, you know what? That's how it is. You just got to keep hacking away, man.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle-infested conversation to give a special shout-out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kauk signature Fluence Gristle Tone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains. So when you're touring all the time, it's probably just like we do. You're just like a vehicle and a trailer, a van. What are you hauling?
So I bought a Sprinter van about 8 or 9 years ago.
Okay.
And that's well maintained, and I built it out so that there's a couple bunks in there, and the back is all closed off. It's one of those oversized ones, and it carries all our gear and all our luggage, and we haul around in that bad boy.
Good for you. I 2 days ago, I put a down payment on a Ford Transit cargo van, but I'm building that. But now it's going down to Ohio to get extra set of extra row of seats and then a bulkhead where we can put all the gear in back, and away we'll go. Because prior to that, we've been using Toby, the organ player. He has a Tahoe and a trailer, and we've been hauling that around. But that vehicle just turned over 200,000 miles. He's like, I think old Bessie may have gone on her last long trip. I was like, it's time for me to get the new gristle missile. So I finally, our next trip out west, we're going to be in the new digs.
Yeah, I've got Moby Dick, the great white whale, big old white Sprinter van. But I got lucky with that one because right when COVID was happening, she started giving me problems, and Mercedes wanted to charge me about $5,000 to fix it, and I was like, well, I'm not going anywhere for a while with this COVID thing, so I'll just save up some money and fix it when we get back on the road. And then right about a year and a half after, when things started picking up again, I called a mechanic friend of mine. He says, hey, man, just give me your VIN number. And he gives me I gave him the VIN number. He goes, hey, man, there's a recall on your van. Call it.
Oh, no kidding.
I called him and said, they rebuilt my whole engine, man. I got like 30,000 miles on a rebuilt engine
now. Nice.
So
awesome.
That was the only thing that benefited me during COVID.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, you know, the since COVID, it's the first real, I mean, tons of road work that we've done with the band in the States. I mean, I've done road work over the years, you know, doing clinics and, you know, been all over the place in the States doing that. And we would just do kind of gigs hither and yon as we would find anchor gigs and kind of book around that. But I finally got a great booking agent. So we've been going out and, you know, and I guess I was always of the mind of, well, you need to have, you know, rock solid guarantees everywhere and da 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 da. And then I got this agent's like, look, you know, you're going to have some guarantees, but some are going to be door deals, and you're better off doing a door deal where you're guaranteed to make good money if people show up versus some lame guarantee versus a bad back end deal. And I'm like, okay. And we've gone on the road, and it's like, and during COVID, we did so many live streams, and, you know, I've been building up all this goodwill, you know, online, that people show up, and I'm realizing, man, you don't need a million people coming out to see you. You just need enough. And we go out and we make enough people come out They're only to see you. They buy the merch, you hang out with them, and out the door you go. And it's the most fun I think I've had, you know, in my life playing. You know, it's fantastic.
But that's because you are proactive. What I was just talking about, I've been following you for years, and I've seen interviews, read interviews. I've seen you on YouTube a million times doing, you know, product reviews, doing stuff for the music stores. Now you're doing this podcast. You did the live streaming. That's what proactive is. That's how you do. That's how you're able to be successful, man. And that's awesome.
Well, I appreciate that. It's just so fun to just go out and play.
Right? I mean, I don't want to give away the golden secret here, but man, I don't get paid for what I do on stage. It's right. Everything in between.
Exactly. Yep. I would agree with that. But, you know, there's nothing to be said for, I mean, everyone's like, well, don't those long drives and stuff, don't you? It's like, it's a blast. You're hanging out with your buddies. You're listening to music. You can stop wherever you want to stop. You can eat wherever you want to eat, you know, and in some ways, you know, and again, this is only because I haven't had the perspective of the other side, but I've never been on a big tour with tour buses. I mean, I just got done doing the Almond Betts thing, and that was a lot of fun. I was there for 3 days, but I just drove myself. But man, the idea of being on a bus with God knows how many other people and you're only showering at the venues and, you know, and getting hotels every night. I mean, I'm sure it's awesome if you're doing it, but for me, it's like, I would probably go crazy doing that. I just like to be free.
Yeah, I get it. There's a lot to be said for having, you know, a really nice, comfortable tour bus, but also, man, you better be selling a lot of tickets, because that's a lot of overhead for
right stuff.
And but having your own vehicle, I've always let's just say when I got old enough to figure it out, I figured out early that, like, I don't want to be blaming someone else for my failures, and right. I like accepting my successes and being cool that, like, I pointed in the right direction. And if I fail, I don't want to yell at anyone else or get pissed at someone else. I'll fully take the blame.
Right.
I got no problem doing that. So I love being able, I'm not a megalomaniac, and I do take suggestions, and the guys in my band help out with a lot of stuff. But I do like that freedom, like you said, of just it's us on the road. That's my family. When I leave the driveway, this is my family.
And right.
Sometimes, you know, we go through stuff that, you know, you don't even go through in your own family.
Right.
And there's things I know about my guys in my band, and they know about me that probably our families don't know.
Right. You
know? So I like that aspect too. I like being on the road. I like having, you know, my own choices to make like that. But, you know, with everything, it's not always, you know, a can of peaches,
right?
And, you know, there's always something. But the other thing I have learned too, and I'm sure you have too, is, like, I've played with guys that are amazing musicians that were miserable people, and I don't want to be around miserable people anymore. I don't care.
Absolutely.
I'm very fortunate that I have amazing musicians, and they're all good guys too.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I have a one strike and you're out rule, and it's never come to, like, words or blows. It's just like, you know, my new favorite pet saying I came up with is, there's a last time for everything. And you just reach a certain thing where, you know, you just know the people you want to hang with, and you know the people that are going to be high maintenance. And yeah, when you're spending a lot of time in close proximity, that's one of the reasons why I've always just done trios, because then I only have to worry about two other people. And now one of them is my kid. So now I really only have to worry about one. And he's just an absolute pleasure to travel with. So yeah, it's, you know, you find a good squad of folk, and it's all great. But to your point, man, you get someone who isn't fun, or is, you know, and there's reindeer games at hand, man, that's just... that makes the road an
unpleasant place. Poisons the whole barrel, man.
That's right.
Poisons the whole barrel. And I've been in big bands and small bands. I've done trios and four pieces and five pieces. Mostly we do a five piece on the road. This last tour was a four piece. You see me around town just doing a three piece because two of my guys live out of the state. But I will say that it took me a long time to figure this one out as a band leader. And I realized you can't talk to everybody in the same manner. You can't treat every individual as one individual. You have to learn everyone's personality and learn how to deal with each one of them on their level of personality. And it's still not an easy task, even when you know like how to talk to someone. Like, I can't talk to this guy the way I talk to this guy, and I can't like make this suggestion like I would make to this. It's like being a psychologist and a grade school teacher at the same time.
Right. Exactly.
You know, but I'm not a barrel of fun all the time either. I love to have fun and I love to crack wise. And I love to, here's what I tell people. I'm kind of a lot. And I realize that. And I know you know what I'm talking about because I see you, but kind of a lot. I get it. I'm not for everybody.
Right.
But I own who I am.
Exactly.
I know I'm that way. And so, like, if I see I'm making someone uncomfortable or putting someone off, I back off and I say, hey, man, you know, I'm just messing. I'm just cool. Man.
Right, right.
Just tell me, I'm not gonna hurt my feelings. But yeah, you got to be all kinds of stuff, man, in this business.
Right. There's a bunch of things that need to be in the toolbox in order to get along.
Yeah, for sure.
Without a doubt. Now let's talk a little bit about, because you had your own record company for years, but you've been on Alligator now for a minute. Now, how talk a little bit about that situation, the difference between doing everything on your own, which is where I'm at right now, and I've had deals, and you know they're all different, but yet they're all kind of the same. And I'm just wondering how things have gone for you in that regard.
Well, you know, when I first decided to do my own record and my first record in 97, right? That was right after I left Jimmy Rogers' band. And I thought, oh man, I played with Jimmy Rogers for 3 years. I've been on the road with Legendary Blues Band for 3 years. I played with Jimmy Dawkins. I'm a seasoned vet. I can get a record deal in no time. And nobody answered the phone. Nobody sent me anything back. And I was like, oh, okay. And then, you know, I was very fortunate to meet my wife early on at the time before we were even dating, you know, Kate, my lovely bride, Kate, and she was already in the business doing stuff for Delmark. So she kind of had a head for how to do this kind of thing.
Okay.
Graphic designer. She's like, I'll help you. You just do it yourself, you know? And Linwood Slim, the late, great Linwood Slim, great harmonica player, vocalist from out of LA who produced my first couple. And he was like, man, fuck that shit. Do it yourself, man.
Right.
You don't need these guys. And so that's what I did. And my very first record out of the gate got nominated Best New Artist thing for the, back then it was called the Handy Awards. And
oh yeah.
Yep. The BMAs. But I got nominated for a Handy Award right out of the gate on my very first record. And then started, you know, being noticed by some of the record people. They still weren't like not beating down my door. So I was just putting out records and just getting like all this critical acclaim from DJs and writers. They loved the stuff I was doing. And I was able to start touring pretty early and building up a fan base and playing. And it got to the point where like I didn't, by my third or fourth CD, I really wasn't pursuing anyone.
Sure.
Figured out. And we were actually adding people onto our label. Like I had like the guys from the Cashbox Kings, one of their first albums was on our label. Matt Stubbs from GA20, one of his first albums was on our label. Jerry Hunt, he put out his solo record on my label, harmonica player out of Indiana who used to tour with Jimmy Rogers in the 70s, Bill Lupkin, put out an album. So I was like, oh man, I got a legit label now. And then we kept that going. And then my daughter was born during that time. And then I think when Sadie was about 11 years old, 12 years old, my wife got an offer to go back into the kind of the public sector work. She's a graphic designer, but she was freelance and was always home and could do all these things. And I was on the road so much, so she was really carrying the load as being the record label head and doing things. But she got offered this job from one of her clients who had been begging her for like 10 years to come work for her at a PR firm. And finally, my wife said, well, you know what? It's a really good offer. It's good insurance. The money's guaranteed, or I'm not always worried about when my next gig's going to come.
Sure.
Aunt Sadie's old enough, you know. So she took this job, and it just became too time consuming for her to do that and me to do this and be on the road and her to do that. And I would say like right around 2015, I kind of was putting a bug in Bruce's ear about trying to do something. And I think at one point he wanted to do something, but the timing wasn't right. And that was when Mike Ledbetter was in my band.
Right.
It just never happened. And then when Mike left the band and Dennis Grunling joined my band, and we went back more towards a more traditional blues style, Bruce all of a sudden was like, you know what? That's a pairing I'd like to sell, and I'm ready to do it. And I'm like, okay. And we went and talked to him. And I remember the meeting that I had at Alligator before I signed any papers, because Bruce is like, I want you to meet the staff. And we went up to the office up there, and I didn't realize how many people worked at Alligator there. I thought it was like 4 or 5 people.
Right.
He was like, he's got like 13 people working for him then. And they're all sitting around in this little tiny room in this old brownstone building on the north side of Chicago. Walk up this crickety old stairs, and there's offices, looks like from the 1960s, of paperwork all over the desk is Bruce's office. And you walk in this little lobby area with a little desk that Jill sits in, and then a kitchen area. And there's all these people sitting around the table, and they had a speaker phone, and there was 3 people on the speaker phone. I'm like, what's going on here? And everyone went around the table introducing themselves and telling like what their purpose was and what their job was. And I just remember sitting there thinking, wow, we never did any of that stuff. What the hell did we do this for so long? And as soon as I said that in my brain, Bruce was like, oh, and you guys should know Nick and his lovely wife, they had their own record label for the last, you know, 10 or 12 years, and they were very successful doing what they did. I was like, no, we weren't, man. Just hear what you're doing, bro. So I was very glad to sign on and not have to do anything, and then also have that team behind me, because they're great. They really are. And yeah, man, everyone there's been good.
Awesome.
Really great publicity machine. And I've come to really, I thought I knew Bruce all those years, but I really have come to know him more now being part of the Alligator family. And he's one of the most dedicated guys. Like, if some would say to the point of annoyance, because he's always got his hands in. And like, I don't know if you've ever sent Bruce anything, but Bruce will answer you back. If you send him a record, he will listen to it. And I know thousands of people do, and he answers them all.
Wild.
It's like a very detailed breakdown of the record, of the songs, what he likes, what he doesn't like, what you could have done better. Like, it's amazing. And also, if you get him to start talking about the old days and talking about the old guys.
Right.
Like, you can see, like, in his eyes, like, he just goes away, like he's back there in that time, and his, just like the way he speaks to these guys, you can tell like this is his love, man. He loves it.
Awesome. That's cool. So how long have you, since about 2015, you reckon?
I believe we signed in 17.
Nice.
Yeah. So
that's wild. Your wife's a graphic designer. Cause that's what my wife does.
Yeah. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. And she's always done all my artwork, and it was kind of the same thing too. She stayed home with the kids for a long time and was doing freelance stuff. And I was just traveling like a mad dog doing my thing. And then finally, a few years back now, she got a job at a college. So the benefits were magnificent. Cause that's what used to just kill me was the self-employed doing the insurance thing, man. Oh,
and well, with four kids. Years, yeah, man. And until a few years ago, I was high risk because of my kidneys, man. That was bad trying to pay for insurance for me.
Oh,
Yeah.
Fun.
In fact, I had to like beg insurance companies to take me, and then it was like through the roof just for me.
Yeah. Nightmare.
But man, I get it. My wife, she still does freelance stuff, but now she's the art director at the Shedd Aquarium.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. She's having fun doing that now.
That's cool. You gotta love that.
Yeah, man.
So let's talk a little bit about gear, because that's just fun. Okay. Gear is fun.
Let's talk about it.
So what are you hauling around these days as you tour around? And because I know it changes, you know, for me, it's like I started off with ideas of what I wanted to take on the road. And then I switched to this.
Awesome back there.
Oh, yeah. I got my gauntlet of amplifiers. And then I ended up using I think when I played with you, I was still using two amps, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just realized I just need one amp with 12s as opposed to two amps with 10s.
So on my last tour, I 58 Tweed Pro.
Nice.
With a 15, it was an amp that was it may have been in a fire at one time. So the only thing that's original on it is the chassis, and then I had a guy salvage everything he could out of the guts. And then replace what needed to be replaced. And then I found an old Jensen P15 and put that in there. And so that blew about a year or so ago. And then I put in there recently? And I like it. Actually, it was the Weber California. Mm-hmm. Californian I put in there with the El Nico speaker. And that's the amp I've been playing a lot in the last year and a half, maybe two years. I've got that one. And then my backup amp is a 61 Brown Pro.
Nice.
With a JBL.
So you just take those two along, you use one, and if something goes awry, you grab the other one.
Yeah. Or if I get the chance to play in a big room and I want to just get loud,
you'll fire them both up.
Yeah, when we're out in California in early November, we played this big armory in San Luis Obispo. Big armory and big stage, and I had both of them going. And then we played, our last gig was in Salt Lake City at a pretty big venue. So and we did that as a trio because it was on the drive home and I left the guys in California. So it was just me, Rodrigo, and Pierce did the last gig in Salt Lake City. And I had my pro on my side, and I put the Brown bro next to Rodrigo's bass amp on the other side of the stage, and it was glorious.
Yeah.
So those are the rig I run, not all the time, but on the last tour, that's what I did. But before COVID was right before COVID, man, I was just playing just to keep with the theme. But a vastly different amp. I had two of those little Pro Juniors.
I used to use those all the time.
Yeah, the little
15 watts of glory.
Yeah, the little 10-inch ones, yep. Not the 12-inch ones.
Right, the 10s, but the two knobs, tone and volume.
And they're killer, man. And I would put one on either side of the bass drum.
There you go.
Because my old drummer was like that dude, Patrick Seals, man. Patrick, I love him. He's still like a brother to me, man. But that dude was the only drummer I've ever been with that didn't want any of his drums in his monitor and and would constantly ask me to turn my guitar up. I'm like, what? He wanted more guitar and no drums in his monitor. I'm like, okay. So I started doing that, putting like one. I had two in the van because they're small.
Right.
And I could get by with one in most places because they're actually loud.
Yeah, man. They are. They totally are.
Halfway in the tour one time, Patrick goes, "Hey, man, you got another one of those in the van." I go, "Yeah." He goes, can you use two of them and put one on the other side of my bass drum?" And I was like, "Dude, you're sick and I love you."
So yeah, I was two of those for a while. There was even a while where I was using four of them. I would put them on, I'd stack them on the sides, and then I forgot how I split the signal, but I'd split it somehow. And then I ran this Leslie simulator and I had two on one side and two on the other. And I would haul them around in those, like, you know, Target Rubbermaid, you know, I just pop them in there and away you go.
I saw a video of Jeff Beck playing some show in London.
Ronnie Scott's, he used one of those. Yeah.
No, he's got a bunch of them on stage, like a wall of them almost. And I was like, shit, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great little amp. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it does that thing where you can run it a little clean and then kick it over the top with something, or you can just turn it up and use the volume control on your guitar. And there it is. I mean, I've used them on a bunch of recordings.
Yeah.
You know, a bunch of my old records. And I was like, how'd you get that sound? I go, those are all Pro Junior tracks. I just turn it up.
Yeah, man. That I still have one underneath the bench in my van. So that's my last resort. In case my big pros go down, I still got that guy.
Yeah, they're killer.
Actually, that's a nice sound too. I ran the little Pro Junior and my Tweed Pro together.
Oh yeah,
zeros a couple times, and that's a nice sound.
I would do stuff like back in the day. I remember I'd have a bassman, and I would use the Pro Junior as like a preamp for it. So I would take remember those little things called the Red Box where you can go direct with them. And they sounded good. They were speaker simulated out. I'd take a speaker simulated out from the Pro Junior and put it into the basement of the Super Reverb. And so I'd get all the warmth and the kind of the gristle, if you will, from the Pro Junior. And then it would just amplify it through the other amp. It was awesome.
Oh, man. I've got a... Dude, now we're totally nerding out. Okay, so I've got like this early 60s Gibson Skylark. No, it was at the... Which one is it? It's got a 12 in it. But it's got a line out on it.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing. Again, my drummer, because he was at that time, he was such a lunatic. I would just put that behind my amp, and I was running a basement then, a Tweed basement.
Yeah.
And I'd run that amp, and I'd put it behind my amp on a drum case facing right in his ear.
So he could hear it.
Yeah, and then run the line out into my basement and use that Gibson into my basement.
Yeah,
that sounded awesome.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, we just, I like playing around with stupid shit like that.
That's just fun.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
I just started just trying to, I guess, man, just getting old. I don't want to carry big, heavy amps anymore. I played Supers for so long early in my career, Supers, and they're just so damn heavy now. And I'm a big dude, man. They're still too heavy.
They are not light. I like heads and cabinets now. It's like for the longest time I loved combos, but then I realized, well, you can have one speaker cabinet and bring along two heads instead of bringing two combos as one for a spare. And I was like, well, that makes sense. So I've been having fun with the 212 cabinet and then using the head and then just bringing along a spare head. And if anything goes awry, I just pop that on top instead of hauling around more shit.
That works.
Well, listen, Nick, it was so much fun hanging out with you. We'll do it again on January 10th down at Fitzgerald's there in Chicagoland.
And yeah, it's gonna be fun. You are the inaugural. I can't even speak. My first guest. I'll just say,
yeah. There you go. Perfect.
The first of the series that we'll be doing every month. There, where I'm just bringing a musician out, and again, gonna be loose, kind of like this, where you come out and you'll talk, and going to be Chicago centric. I want you to think about this. I want you to tell me about like what like the Chicago blues music that you grew up
being
so close had anything to do with your playing.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. So we will have no problem conversing on that subject.
Yeah, man. It'll be fun.
And then we'll do some playing as well. Well, listen, you have a good Christmas, good holidays.
You too.
And say hello to the fam for me. Say hello to Kate for me. And we'll talk soon. Thank you so much for joining us today on Chewing the Damn Gristle.
Chewing the Gristle. Thanks for having me, bud. I appreciate
it. My pleasure. Take it easy. Have a good one.
Take it easy.
We'll see you. Thank you so much, folks, for tuning in. Special thank you to Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, and the mighty Fishman Transducers for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed yourself, ladies and gentlemen, please subscribe and review so that people can get the word out that this is worth experiencing. Can you dig it? Thanks again. We'll see you soon, or you'll hear me soon.